The 1976 film All the President's Men told the story of two reporters who uncovered Watergate and brought down a president. Will the film Spotlight awaken interest in investigative journalism in the same way? It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Spotlight tells the story of a team of investigative journalists at the Boston Globe who broke the story of the Catholic Church sex abuse scandal. And in this scene from the Academy Award-nominated movie, the Spotlight team is meeting with Marty Baron, who was editor of the Globe at the time. They're talking about how much Bernard Francis Law, Archbishop of Boston at the time, knew about a pattern of child sex abuse by priests.
Law had to know. That's why he had the reaction. He knew there were others.
I think that's the bigger story.
But the numbers clearly indicate that there were senior clergy involved.
That's all they do. Indicator.
Are you telling me that if we run a store with 50 pedophile priests in Boston...
Mike, we'll get into the same catfight you got into on Porter, which made a lot of noise, but changed things not one bit. We need to focus on the institution, not the individual priests. Practice and policy. Show me the church manipulated the system so that these guys wouldn't have to face charges. Show me they put those same priests back into parishes time and time again. Show me this was systemic, that it came from the top down.
Sounds like we're going after Law.
Okay, there's an excerpt from Spotlight, nominated for Academy Award in several categories, including Best Picture. This hour, we want to use Spotlight as a jumping-off point to find out where investigative journalism stands today at a time of media fragmentation, the 24-hour news cycle, and our financially struggling newspapers. Support for today's program comes from a grant from the Pulitzer Prizes Board and Humanities Iowa as a part of the celebration of the 2016 Centennial of the Pulitzer Prizes. If you'd like to join our conversation, tell us about your questions, your concerns about the state of investigative journalism. Do you want this kind of reporting from your news organization? Are you willing to pay for it? 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. We're also on Facebook. Joining us, first of all, Andy Hall, executive director and co-founder of Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism, joining us by phone. Andy Hall, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Ben. Good to be here.
Good to have you with us with your expertise in investigative journalism. I understand you saw the movie just last night.
Yes, I was able to get a good look at it and thoroughly enjoyed it. It brought back a lot of memories of my own history going back into the 70s and 80s as a young journalist and what it's really like when you're down in the trenches of a story trying to put the pieces together. It's a fantastic movie.
You've broken a number of investigative stories in your own right. You broke the story of the Keating Five while working at the Arizona Republic, I believe.
Yes.
The story of five U.S. senators accused of corruption in the late 80s. This was all part of that larger savings and loan crisis in the 80s and early 90s. So tell me, does Spotlight have the... ability to inspire the way All the President's Men did in the 70s?
Well, you know, I think it will inspire some to get into the field of journalism and investigative journalism. I'm one of those people who jumped into journalism in the 70s, largely as a result of Watergate and having seen All the President's Men. I was one of those people flooding into the journalism schools at the college level at that point. I attended Indiana University starting in 1977. And journalism was seen, especially investigative journalism, was seen then as a kind of a cool, glamorous, and very important profession, something that was helping right wrongs across our nation. I think certainly Spotlight will help make that case to today's young people that journalism can accomplish good for our communities, can take on powerful institutions when they're failing to regulate themselves effectively. I do have to say, though, that today's economics of journalism are entirely different from what they were at the time of Watergate. So the idealism is still there. The potential for journalism to accomplish good is still there. But the money really isn't in the way that it was in the 70s. So that's going to be our continuing challenge at the local, state, and national level.
Mm-hmm. We want to get into that a little bit later, how the structures have changed, how the environment, the landscape has changed for investigative journalism a little bit later. Andy Hall with us, executive director, co-founder of the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism. Join us with your questions, your concerns about the state of investigative journalism, 1-866-780-9100. Perhaps it's good at this point, the early part of the program, Andy, for you to define investigative journalism. What sets it apart from beat journalism, everyday, I'll just call it everyday journalism?
Yeah, sure. That's a great question. You know, there's no one definition of investigative journalism that everybody agrees to, but Investigative Reporters, a great nonprofit training organization based at the University of Missouri, publishes something called the Reporter's Handbook. And the Reporter's Handbook contains a definition that's very expansive and I think works well for most of us. And it basically says that investigative journalism is based on a reporter's own initiative, and it examines issues of community importance. And in some cases, there may be an element of resistance present. That is, somebody doesn't want you to get the story. I personally think, and I think most of my colleagues agree, If you're effective in persuading reluctant sources to turn over information, to share insights, you've still got an investigative story. You just happen to be good at talking people into giving you things. And that element of independence, the idea that it's a reporter's own initiative, is really essential. The idea that we're not beholden to a single source or to, you know, what is simply said or handed to us at a news conference, but we're out there independently piecing together information to reveal the truth in hopes that when given that truth or those truths, the public and the policymakers will do the right thing and our democracy will flourish.
You mentioned memories that the spotlight brought up for you, going back to your early days, many decades of working in this field. I wonder if you could sort of tell me about a trigger in spotlight that triggered a memory, and what specific memory it triggered.
Well, you know, there were scenes in the movie where the reporters were looking through the old church directories, trying to figure out where different priests had been stationed. And at first, you know, they say things like, well, they were on sick leave or the priest was on leave and wasn't at a parish. And they start to learn that the truth is it's part of a bigger pattern of priests who had been engaged in sexual abuse being pulled out of those parishes to go to a treatment center. So to me, that triggered memories of us looking through old records in the Keating 5 investigation, looking through what seemed at first to be nondescript records regarding Senator John McCain's political and business activities, the financial disclosure forms that all members of Congress have to file. And we saw a couple partnerships listed in there. One was Fountain Square Limited Partnership. And I remember opening up that record, figuring out, well, what is this partnership, and seeing that the senator's wife was engaged in a financial investment in a shopping center with Charlie Keating, who at that time was under federal investigation following the loss of some $2 billion in taxpayers' money through Lincoln Savings and Loan. And I remember yelling in our little newsroom where the investigative team worked at the Arizona Republic, yelling, "Eureka!" We found it. Like, that was the first strong tie that we discovered between the senator and Charlie Keating that hadn't been disclosed. And it was a major breakthrough, led to additional breakthroughs involving other connections, and helped all of us, I think, understand why five powerful senators intervened on Mr. Keating's behalf to try to get the federal regulators off of his back.
And then the adrenaline rushes on from that moment on.
Yes.
And you're digging and you're strategizing about how to get the more information to corroborate.
Yes, exactly. And not knowing, you know, where you're going to end up, what the next record might tell you, you know, what the source might tell you. We actually did have one case in the Keating 5 investigation where we obtained some key information from a source at a parking garage, reminiscent of the Deep Throat situation in Watergate. So that's the only time in my life, by the way, I've ever gone to a parking garage to get information from a source. It did trigger memories of how it had worked for Woodward and Bernstein as well.
Yeah, and you said the information you're getting is information that people, some people, do not want you to have. What barriers were thrown up in front of you in that specific case?
In the Keating 5 case, barriers were, you know, similar to what I see today, decades later. People in power engage in certain conduct that they don't want the public to know about. So they either don't put the information into public records in the first place, or they get upset when you start uncovering information that was in the records. They then engage in attempts to intimidate and bully the journalists into backing off the story. You certainly saw that in play with the Boston Globe spotlight situation, with the power of the Catholic Church in the Boston area. So, you know, these dynamics really haven't changed over the decades or even over the centuries. Journalists are out there confronting the powerful and seeking a pathway so that the public can understand what's being done by the people in power. We use records. We also have to depend upon human sources, some of whom are under some duress or could suffer repercussions if they were to divulge that information. We're involved in stories like that right now here at our small nonprofit news operation in Wisconsin. Sources who are sharing some information with us at some risk to themselves, because ultimately they want the right thing to be done. So it's inspiring to deal with people like that, and we try to speak up for the powerless. As part of our three guiding values here, say protect the vulnerable, expose wrongdoing, and seek solutions. Mm-hmm. Same thing you saw at work in Spotlight, looking out for the interests of people who don't have a voice. And as I said before, hoping that when provided with reliable information, that the public and policymakers do the right thing and are democracy continues to be strong.
Mm-hmm. You said so much has not changed. The process, you're describing the craft of investigative journalism very well there. But then you also reminded us that the landscape, the media, news media landscape has changed dramatically in the last few decades. Give us a quick nutshell description of what was then and what is now in terms of how investigative journalism works in an environment.
Sure. Well, investigative journalism has never been able to pay for its own way. It's always been subsidized by something or somebody else. And we didn't really know it at the time, but in, you know, the 70s, 80s, 90s, early 2000s, that was really a golden era for investigative reporting, because printing presses were pretty much, money presses. They were churning out 30-40% profit margins for newspaper companies, which then in turn could afford to subsidize investigative reporting teams consisting of maybe a couple people, maybe three or four or five people, maybe even 10 people at a news organization to devote the time and resources and expertise that it requires to dig into some of these stories that aren't just being handed to us by sources. What has happened, of course, is with the rise of the internet, we've seen a total disruption in the business model, a decline of unprecedented and catastrophic proportions in the 60-70% range at many news organizations, a decline in advertising revenue, both the display ads as well as the classified ads. Similar losses at many news organizations and circulation revenue as well. The print side revenue still accounts for 80-90% of the revenue at most news organizations today, even with the rise of digital operations and the production of so many digital ads and other digital revenue products. So what you're left with is diminishing resources that are unable to by and large, support the kind of reporting enterprise and investigative teams that we saw across America in previous decades. Mm-hmm. So we're left now with pared down newsrooms, hollowed out newsrooms in many cases, staff decreases of 30-40-50% over the past decade are not uncommon. You're seeing that played out in the State House news bureaus, as well as the number of reporters assigned in Washington to cover things for the people back home. So fewer watchdogs is what we have, and a number of people, including myself, Lyle Muller at Iowa Watch, and many of our colleagues across the country are trying to do something about that by helping to invent some new models to stave off some of those losses.
Okay, Andy Hall is with us of the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism, and right on cue, Andy, you mentioned Lyle Muller. We have him on our program today as well. He's in our Ames studio, executive director of Iowa Watch, and it would be fair to say that as a nonprofit, Iowa Watch is to Iowa what Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism is to that state. Lyle Muller, welcome to the program.
Hello, Ben.
So tell us, since Andy talked about the changing environment, financial structures that can support or not support investigative journalism, how does your organization, Andy's organization, exist? How are they funded?
We're funded with foundation money. A huge funder of us is the Ethics and Excellence in Journalism Foundation. And without them, Iowa Watch, frankly, wouldn't exist because they've been able to give us an awful lot of money over the years. More than $300,000 in our first 3.5 years and going into a fourth year, now fifth year of funding. And when I say that, we also have to do matching funds. So that means going out to Iowans and trying to get donations or foundations in Iowa to support us. We also get funding from media partners. So a huge one is the Gazette Company, one of my former employers, and they provide us some funding. Donors and services are the other areas, and then events. So it's a bit of a hard scrabble kind of life. We call ourselves scrappy because we're always trying to figure out and invent ways to get funding to support this journalism.
Mm-hmm. Given the decades you've worked in the news media for decades, Lyle, given Andy Hall's sort of account of how that's changed over the decades, how would you say the state of investigative journalism is here in Iowa at the current time compared to the past?
Strong investigative journalism still exists in Iowa. The problem is fewer people are doing it. If you take a look at the state of Iowa and look at the rosters at different newspapers in the state, and I'm not talking about television stations simply don't have the ability to assign one person to sit and do an investigative project over several months and have that be the only product of that reporter. But if you look at newspapers in Iowa, the Des Moines Register has Jason Clayworth and Lee Rude, who are dedicated investigative reporters who are told you can go out and find things and take some time and unpeel the layers that exist here. The Gazette has Aaron Jordan. And there you go. Those are the three people whose jobs in Iowa are identified in the traditional media as full-time investigative reporters. That doesn't mean that reporting doesn't exist. There are plenty of other people doing fantastic work at the Register, the Gazette, Telegraph Herald, Quad City Times, whatever the paper is. It's just that that's not their regular job. They're expected to do investigative reporting while also covering some of the routine matters, which are important. That's watchdog journalism. They just don't have the time and ability to devote months to a project.
Let me ask you, what sets an investigative journalist apart? You've worked with so many journalists over the year. How do you spot one, or how do you train one?
Well, first of all, I would like to suggest that all reporters should be investigative journalists. That's the nature that we take into our roles. We want to be able to not accept what people say, but rather learn what is. And that falls into the routine reporting that you get, whether it be a city council meeting, a traffic accident, a crime, or an enterprise story. So you want to take that role into the reporting that you do. But I would say what really sets you aside in Iowa is that, and it's the same thing Andy's talking about, is that you as the reporter are allowed to let your curiosity roam and go through documents and go and talk to people and try to figure out what really is happening. And if you run into a roadblock, try to identify that, set aside the things that aren't pertinent to your investigation, and to continue to pursue all of the avenues that exist. And it could take a long time to do this, and you might be doing it while you're doing other types of projects. But that's what I think would set aside someone who is identified as an investigative reporter from someone who would be a routine reporter.
Mm-hmm. We have just a few seconds before we go to break, but you mentioned the barriers there, too. And you have to be the sort of person that I mean, when you meet resistance, you've talked to, I'm sure, plenty of reporters, Lyle, you meet resistance, that doesn't mean stop. That can mean you're getting close.
Well, that is true, and I've certainly met that as a reporter in the past. I've met it as an editor, and I've worked with reporters who have run into that. I think one of the interesting things you were talking about, Spotlight, is that Robbie Robinson, the head of that team, continued to be a conduit between those who were in charge of the business side of the paper and those who were doing the journalism, the reporting, the members of his team, so he would cajole them and work with them and lead them, but also deal with some of the internal politicking that went on, which he, of course, I don't want to ruin the end of the movie here, but which
no spoilers.
He, of course, was involved with himself.
Okay, Lyle Muller, hang on, Executive Director of Iowa Watch, Andy Hall of the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism. We're talking about the state of investigative journalism this hour. Spotlight, the movie, is something that we're looking to, perhaps as an inspiration, like All the President's Men was in the 1970s. Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. When we come back, we'll also add Jason Clayworth, mentioned there, an excellent investigative reporter for the Des Moines Register. That's when we return. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. And we're back midstream in this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This hour we've been exploring where investigative journalism stands at a time of media fragmentation, our 24-hour news cycle, and also financially struggling news organizations. And at the renewed attention this form of reporting is getting with the Academy Award nomination for Spotlight as Best Picture. It has five other Academy Award nominations. In this scene from the movie, reporter Mike Resendez is arguing with the editor of the Spotlight team, Robbie Robinson, about when to break the story.
We got law. This is it.
No, this is law covering for one priest. There's another 90 out there.
Yeah, and we'll print that story when we get it, but we got to go with this now.
No, I'm not going to rush the story, Mike.
But we don't have a choice, Robbie. If we don't rush to print, somebody else is going to find these letters and butcher this story. Joe Quimby from the Herald was at the freaking courthouse.
Mike.
What? Why are we hesitating? Barron told us to get law. This is law.
Barron told us to get the system. We need the full scope. That's the only thing that will put an end to this.
Then let's take it up to Ben. Let him decide.
We'll take it to Ben when I say it's time.
It's time, Robbie. It's time. They knew, and they let it happen. Two kids. Okay? It could have been you. It could have been me. It could have been any of us. We gotta nail these scumbags. We gotta show people that nobody can get away with this. Not a priest or a cardinal or a freaking pope.
Okay. Very amazing clip from Spotlight, the Academy Award-nominated film telling the story of a team of investigative journalists at the Boston Globe, breaking the story on the Catholic Church sex abuse scandal. And joining us for this discussion of investigative journalism today, Andy Hall, executive director and co-founder of the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism, Lyle Muller, executive director of Iowa Watch, two nonprofits that look after investigative journalism in those respective states. Also joining us this half hour, Jason Clayworth, investigative reporter at the Des Moines Register in our Des Moines studio. Jason, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me, Ben.
We've spoken to you many times on this program. We want to remind our listeners, last fall, you were at the front end of investigating and reporting how, for instance, just to recount some of your recent investigative work, how corporations poised to take over management of Iowa's Medicaid program have each been held accountable in other states for serious service and administrative areas. More recently, you've been investigating flaws in Iowa's teacher background check system. Let me ask you the question, how do these things start as an investigative reporter? Where do the seeds come from?
Multiple areas. We get a lot of calls and emails, letters from our readers that say that there are situations that need to be reviewed and investigated. We also, at least myself personally, I read the paper every day, and there are issues that I believe deserve further review, and that just sparks my curiosity, and I have the luxury oftentimes of pursuing that.
Mm-hmm. And you have how many things in your files right now that potentially could be pursued?
Well, I've worked at the Des Moines Register since 1998. I started as an intern, and since day one, I've kept a scrapbook of ideas, and that just continually grows and evolves. I currently have, I think there's 15 to 20 pages of two or three line story ideas. Mm-hmm. It really is, and it continually changes.
Mm-hmm. And what tells you when to go after a certain story?
Well, sometimes it's the timeliness of a news event. The Medicaid issue, for example, is something that's fast moving and something that requires, in my mind, journalism in my mind is a public service. And with something that is such a big program and massive changes being made, it requires quick journalistic work. And so many times that's a factor that drives, what and when we would cover.
Mm-hmm. Would you look at the work, compare your work with the work of the other reporters who are not investigative journalists dedicated to that? And we just heard our other guests say, of course, investigative journalism should be a part of all good journalism, but you are dedicated to this. Just give us a sense of how your work, your process is different than other more conventional journalists.
I am allotted a lot more time than many of the other traditional journalists, and I fully recognize that and very much grateful for that. But every journalist has, and in my mind, every journalist has a duty to be a watchdog, and as part of that is an investigative reporter. So, while I'm afforded the opportunity to dig a little deeper and spend more time, I think that every true journalist does much of this as well. And I'll say also, it's not that I just, I don't take just 3 months to work on one project, but I'm always updating other stories, other projects that I've written before. And so it's not that, I go 3 months without publishing, having a story published under my byline. So, it's a job that's different than many other traditional journalists across the state, but also very similar in other ways as well.
We just heard that excerpt from the film Spotlight. There an argument between a reporter and the editor of the Spotlight team, Robbie Robinson, about when to break the story, when to go with it. Jason Clayworth, does that echo with you? Does that ring true with you that you're collecting, and then how do you know when that first story hits the page?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the movie really captures the essence of what goes on in a newsroom, and that is debate and conversation. And that's really what makes a newsroom healthy, is that discussion among your peers of what's what and when to write the story and to go after it. I mean, the big discussion in that scene obviously was, you know, whether to pull the trigger at that point. And if they had enough information to show it was a systemic problem. And that's something that a conversation that I have regularly with my editors to see, you know, how much we've got, how what we can show. I mean, it's very – every time we publish a story, our reputation is on the line. And so we have to be very careful. And so sometimes, you know, editors in the newsroom are more – a little more cautious, and so you do have than the reporter might be, and vice versa in other cases, and so you do have this ongoing conversation and dialogue, and it's really quite critical.
Jason Clayworth, investigative reporter at the Des Moines Register, also with us, Lyle Moeller, executive director of Iowa Watch, and Andy Hall, of executive director and co-founder of the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism. Andy Hall, put the nonprofits in context. I know you're aware of players who do this very well at a national and state level. Give us an idea of the organizations that are not nonprofits that do this well.
Or that are nonprofits? Or
that are not nonprofits, since we have you and Lyle there representing the nonprofits. So who else?
Okay, so talk about the people who are the for-profit organizations.
At a national level,
got
yeah.
It. Okay. Yeah, so first of all, I'll say we're in a new era here of collaboration. So you do actually find for-profits and nonprofits collaborating on news coverage. And on the for-profit side, of course, there's superb investigative reporting continuing to be produced by places like the New York Times and the Washington Post, but you also are seeing it at the local level from a number of the Gannett newsrooms, USA Today, certainly the Des Moines Register continues to be noted nationally for it, the strength of its investigative journalism. Here in Wisconsin, the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel has won 3 Pulitzer Prizes in recent years for absolutely outstanding investigative stories that have saved lives and saved taxpayer money. We also should say that small news organizations are producing superb investigative journalism. The Belleville News Democrat in Illinois has garnered national attention for its work in recent years. They did a big package last year. I think it took two of their 5 reporters about 3 months to look into the failure to prosecute sexual assault cases in southern Illinois. So a big commitment of a big percentage commitment of that news organization's resources. In Portland, Maine, the Portland Press did a great investigation last year on this investment scheme that an out-of-state company foisted upon the state legislators, basically tricked the state legislators into legalizing something that let the company come in and get tens of millions of dollars in tax breaks while not creating jobs for the people of Maine. So, you know, you see some great coverage being done in every corner of the country. And in Florida, the Tampa Bay Times and the Sarasota Herald Tribune have teamed up to look into the horrific conditions in the mental hospitals in Florida. So it, when you look at it on a national scale like that, it can be very inspiring to see that despite all these economic difficulties and the massive layoffs that have occurred, the quality of investigative journalism continues to be very strong. The underlying problem, as Lyle noted earlier, is we just don't have as many people doing this journalism as we used to, and that undercuts the free flow of information in communities all across America.
Lyle Moeller, tell us about Iowa Watch and a couple, one or two stories that in the past years you're most proud of that you think really benefited us as an Iowa community.
Sure, a couple come to mind. One was a few years ago we actually collaborated with a number of newspapers, and also with another nonprofit, iNews Rocky Mountain PBS, and took a look at the disparities that existed in opportunities for white, black, and Latino Americans. And the way we did this was we used data that iNews Rocky Mountain PBS had provided for us from the U.S. Census over 50 years. And we looked at what type of rates of home ownership, education, job creation, education, all of these different things that were going on that all of us as Iowans had the opportunity to have, and see whether or not there was a gap in white, Latino, and black Iowans. And we found that there were disparities in home ownership and college graduation rates and high school graduation rates. So that was one. And the fact that it was a collaboration was really gratifying. The other was also a collaboration, and it was recently. Iowa Watch spent the most part of last year as the Iowa Investigator, and the Des Moines Register was the organization that vetted our work. And it was with the Center for Public Integrity, and it took a look at whether or not government is open in Iowa. And we looked at a number of factors, such as the judiciary, the legislature, the governor's office, and there were a number of different criteria that were set out by the Center for Public Investigation. And the reporter at Iowa Watch, Lauren Mills, spent a great deal of time calling and vetting and trying to find out what was going on there. Interestingly, Iowa got something like a D+ for overall openness, but the judiciary got an F, and that's not good. And what we've heard is that the folks at the judiciary in the judicial system have heard this and are taking a look at what they can do to be a little bit more transparent.
Lyle Muller was with us, executive director of Iowa Watch. Bill is on the line joining us from Des Moines. He dialed 1-866-780-9100. Bill, you had the opportunity to work with both Lyle and Jason on a series. Tell us quickly about that.
Well, Lauren did a investigative piece on the failure of the State Historical Society to microfilm newspapers, something that they have been doing for 55 years, but a new director came in and decided it wasn't worth their resources to spend time preserving Iowa newspapers. And Lauren wrote a very important, thoughtful piece. Jason, you've mentioned several things, but I had a chance to work with him on the Lost School series, which not only did he do a fine job as an investigative reporter, but his writing was turned into a documentary that was shown statewide on Iowa Public Television, and I'm still hopeful that that series will prompt the legislature to adequately fund schools, and especially small schools in Iowa. They're kind of on the ropes. We're either going to adequately fund small public schools in Iowa or force more school consolidation, kill more communities. Iowa's made up of small towns and small schools. And so I guess I'm blessed to have had an opportunity to work with both Jason and Lauren.
Okay, Bill, thank you for calling in. Our time is getting away from us. I want to go back to Jason Clayworth, investigative reporter at the Des Moines Register. Is the Des Moines Register investing as much now in investigative journalism in terms of people, resources, as it used to, Jason?
Well, first, I'll say that the Des Moines Register remains dedicated to investigative journalism, and I truly believe it's the savior of the industry. I really do think that because it offers original and revelatory content that other news organizations don't have. I think that's a key answer to some of the problems, not just with newspapers.
But as the industry has encountered problems, since the heyday, have there been cutbacks there?
There have been. Absolutely. Okay. Absolutely. Yeah. There's fewer. I mean, there's no question about it. There are fewer reporters. There are fewer investigative reporters. And it's heartbreaking and it's hard to see. But we still exist. We still have our team put together and we're still doing some really good work. And on the other end of this, I will say something too. I mean, we now have tools available to us that we never had before. And so that is giving us an opportunity to share with readers more of our work. That we now are able, for example, to post databases online that we never had before. It's not all doom and gloom. You know, in the past, all you had was a newspaper and you couldn't research and see if your next door neighbor, was on a sex offender registry or was owed money by the state of Iowa or whatever it might be. And today we have that. So, it's not all bad. There are some bright spots in this as well.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about the next generation, where that's going to come from. I want to start it off by this and having perhaps each of you tell me very briefly. I'm going to give you 5 minutes or less with a prospective candidate. You can hire one investigative journalist and this person's going to walk into your office. Andy, you have just a few minutes. How do you find out whether this person has the wherewithal, is cut out for this type of business?
Well, yeah, I think, Lyle mentioned the right word earlier. Curiosity is the single biggest attribute. Is this person curious about the world and relentlessly curious about everything? How do things work? How are they supposed to work? And how are they really working compared to how they're supposed to work? Secondly, as we heard in that recent clip from Spotlight, any great investigative reporter has to have a sense of outrage, a sense that we are in this to look out for the vulnerable people of our society. We help them attain a voice. We have a responsibility to look out for their best interests when they're not in a position to do so for themselves. So I think that sort of relentless curiosity and a sense of outrage combined with a really strong work ethic and then the ability to continually learn, to adapt, to acquire the kinds of skills that Jason was referencing, the database analysis skills, data visualizations, the ability to gather audio, photography, video, and then the ability to really listen to people so that they get the people, first of all, to relax, to share their story, and then to relate to them in a way that helps people open up. We're put in situations where we're asking people to reveal, in many cases, some of the awfulest moments of their life, whether they were a sexual assault victim, whether they're unable to pay bills, whether they're coping with a mental illness in their family, they've lost a loved one, whatever it is, the ability to empathize with those people and help them see the value in sharing their story with a larger audience so that some good can come out of these situations. All of those things go into being a great investigative journalist.
Mm-hmm. Lyle Muller, anything to add to that? There was a nice comprehensive list by Andy Hall. Perhaps you had anything to add?
I would add someone who's a critical thinker, not a cynical thinker, someone who pursues the truth, is not enamored by someone saying something to them, and that includes even me, to always question and take a look at what you think are the assumptions of truth. And that means I tell young reporters to try to, when they get into a story, try to prove that their story is wrong, because if they can't prove their story is wrong, then they are onto something.
Mm. Jason Clayworth, we have about a minute left. What do you have to add to someone out there who may be interested in this field and want to know a little bit more, and if they're the right stuff to do it?
My advice, I speak once in a while with journalism students, and yeah. I tell them that to me this doesn't feel like a job. This just feels like a life. And so my advice is to pursue journalism and knowing that you're not going to get rich, but you're going to have a really great time.
You're going to have a really great time, and you've been doing that for how many years, Jason?
Almost 20.
Mm-hmm. So someone, a young person out there, should not be discouraged when they hear all the problems in journalism right now. There are jobs for really good people.
There are jobs. It's just changing.
Okay, very good. Jason Clayworth, investigative reporter at the Des Moines Register. Lyle Muller, executive director of Iowa Watch. And Andy Hall of the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism. Thank you all so much for joining us for this hour.
Thank you.
Thanks, Ben.
Thank you.
This program is part of the Pulitzer Prize's Centennial Campfires Initiative, a joint adventure of the Pulitzer Prize's board, the Federation of State Humanities Council, and the Humanities Iowa in celebration of the 2016 Centennial of the Prizes. The initiative seeks to illuminate the impact of journalism and the humanities on American life today, to imagine their future, and to inspire new generations to consider the values represented by the body of Pulitzer Prize-winning work. Support for the Campfires Initiative comes from the Andrew W. Mellon Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Carnegie Corporation of New York, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the Pulitzer Prizes Board, and Columbia University, and Humanities Iowa. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.